Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we take the Highway 29 exit west all the way to Chippewa Falls, and then we snake north of the on the country roads to the little community of New Auburn, Wisconsin, population 485, to catch up with Michael Perry, author, humorist, singer-songwriter, radio host, part-time farmer, and volunteer firefighter, whose books have been critically acclaimed and who will be performing next weekend, Saturday, April 14th, in a Wisconsin Public Radio and Tomorrow River Chautauqua show at the Century Theater in Stevens Point. Michael Perry's books are funny, bittersweet, and sometimes tragic. They're autobiographical reflections on life in a small Wisconsin farming town. Population 485 focuses on Mr. Perry's work as a volunteer firefighter in New Auburn and was described by the Seattle Times as part portrait of a place, part rescue manual, part rumination on life and death, and a beautiful meditation on the things that matter. The Wisconsin State Journal said it may simply be the best book about small-town life ever written. Population 485 was followed by Truck, A Love Story, a book about a rusted-out International Harvester pickup, and most recently by Coop, A Year of Poultry, Pigs, and Parenting. Michael Perry's live performances have been captured on a 2-CD set called Clodhopper Monologues. His latest CD with his band, The Long Beds, is called Tiny Pilot. He is the host of WPR's Tent Show Radio. And if you would like to join the conversation, our lines are open at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. As today on Route 51, we continue our spring regional author series with Michael Perry. Michael, joining us from our Eau Claire studio. Michael, what have you been up to lately?
Well, I've been hitting deadlines, actually. Matter of fact, this morning I recorded 2 Tent Show Radio shows, and then I have an article due for Men's Health Magazine, and it's about Montaigne, of all things. I'm doing my best to integrate philosophy into the men's health way of life. Wow. And I've also just finished the final edits on my next book, which is coming out August 21st. And so I just, as my brothers and I used to say when we were playing chess and checkers together, you took your finger off it. You can't change anything more. And that's how I feel about the book when I finally turn it in for the last time. You took my finger off it, and whatever is there is there.
What's the title of the book?
The title of the book is Visiting Tom. And Tom is my next door neighbor. He's 82 years old. He's lived on the same farm all his life. And he, among other things, makes his own cannons and shoots them.
You're going to laugh at this, but when I moved up to northern Wisconsin from Chicago, I moved in next to a guy who stages fireworks shows here. And he had a cannon on his front yard that he used to shoot off periodically. And it was, I'll tell you, it was a little bit of a culture shock. So,
It is very possible that he is friends with my neighbor because my neighbor knows a guy just like that somewhere up north.
Well, so. we'll see if Lyle knows him. What can folks expect at your appearance next Saturday? That's Saturday, April 14th at the Century Theater in Stevens Point.
Well, I'll tell you what. I try to do a little bit of everything as far as humor. You know, my approach is the same approach that I've had since I was a kid on the farm. I grew up on a dairy farm, milking cows and cleaning calf pens. And I've always said, I think in Population 485, I even wrote that the secret to success is has eluded me because it's still year to year. But the secret to at least getting to where I am has been the same thing that helped me succeed as a farm kid cleaning calf pens for my dad. And that is you just keep shoveling until you got a pile so big someone has to notice. And you're free to extend that metaphor as far as you like concerning my work. I show up. I'm happy to be there, first of all. I'm not a guy who ever set out to be a writer or a performer. For goodness sakes, I was a farm kid in northern Wisconsin. I spent 5 years working on a ranch in Wyoming. I went to nursing school. I have a bachelor's degree in nursing. I worked as a nurse for a while, happily so, and very accidentally wound up operating as a freelance writer, writing for magazines. And then the magazine articles led to a book called Population 45. And so to this day, I'm just happy to be there. And I think that shows. And what you'll see that night, I'll tell stories. I'll read some from the new book. I'll do some material from I do these one-man monologue shows that you referred to it in the introduction, the Clodhopper monologues. And it's everything from talking about the subtle and not so subtle nuances of cows and their nature, mm-hmm. to what it's like to try and be a decent dad. You know, I got started late in the dad game. I was 39 years old before I got married. Just a little bit of everything. And I don't come with any set playlist either. I kind of change it up on the fly depending on the audience.
You're doing so many different things right now. You're the host of Tent Show Radio. You're doing these personal appearances. You're writing these books. You're also writing your own songs and leading your own band. How do you put it all together, and does it surprise you that all of this has happened growing up in a farm family and then moving back to little New Auburn to become a volunteer firefighter, and now look at what you're doing?
Well, a two-part answer. The first part is it really is just evidence that I'm desperately self-employed. And I always say we've been buying our own health insurance since 1992. So I have great incentive to keep a lot of things in the air at once. And so that's part of it. I mean, you're looking at an age when things are changing rapidly in the publishing world. You can't just, unless you sell blockbusters, you can't just sit back and collect royalties. You got to get out there and hustle. And so I do a little bit of everything to try and keep a little something going all the time. As far as, so yes, I'm surprised in that, I said one time at a rather fancy book event out in Los Angeles, some writers were up for awards and everybody was asked to get up and make a little statement, and everyone else spoke quite eloquently. And when I got up, I just said, man, I feel like a guy who got on the wrong bus, but it's a great bus. And so I do feel surprised to be doing what I'm doing. But as far as do I feel surprised to be doing what I'm doing because I'm from New Auburn, Wisconsin? No, not at all. Matter of fact, when I moved back to New Auburn, it was before I'd written any books for any major publishers. I'd self-published mm-hmm. a couple of things, but mostly I was just writing magazine articles. When I moved back to New Auburn, I had a lot of people say, well, I'm not sure what you're thinking there because there's nothing there, town of 485 people. Well, as it turned out for me, everything was there. And I can't say that I moved back with that in mind. I moved back to New Auburn because I was a single guy trying to live on nothing as a writer, and my overhead was low in New Auburn. But then I wound up joining the volunteer fire department and serving on the ambulance service there, and some stories came out of that, turned into a book. And for me, there's this reverse thing where people think nothing's happening in these little towns. Well, goodness, I came from there, and I can tell you that they're filled with characters, and not just characters that resonate in the Midwest. These are characters that exist in every town. I've been on book tour all over the U.S., and these characters are everywhere. So I'm not surprised. There are things of great fascination and interest wherever you go, including small towns.
I want to play a clip from the Clodhopper monologues. It comes out of a story from Population 485. It's about you trying to raise money for the volunteer fire department in a beer tent.
So a little while after I moved back, and I'm still trying to decide if I've made the right decision, I get assigned the duty of going down to the park on Sunday morning of Jamboree Days with one of the old-timers on the department to clean up the beer tent, get it ready for the day. When we get down to the park, it's 8:30 a.m. on Sunday morning. The first softball game of the day is already underway. We're in the beer tent picking up paper plates and plastic cups and napkins, and this guy wanders in off the street. Not a softball player, just a civilian. And he wanders into the beer tent, and he says, "Can I get a beer?" And I looked at my partner, and I said, "Well, it is 8:30 a.m. on Sunday morning, but you've been on the department longer. You make the command decision." And he says, "Well, I guess there's no law against it, So he goes around behind our little makeshift bar there, and he draws the guy a beer, and he sets it down, and the guy hands his money over, and he leans both elbows on the plywood, and he raises the beer to his lips, and he's just about to take a pull at the foam when he hears the crack of the bat on the softball field adjacent, and he freezes. And then he looks. And then he brings his lips back in line with the beer, which has not moved, and says, "Little early in the morning for softball."
Michael Perry, who will be performing at the Century Theater in Stevens Point next Saturday, April 14th, and he's with us right now on Route 51 Talk Radio. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you've read any of his books, if you've listened to his music, if you just want to say hi, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. Michael, Kurt Vonnegut calls volunteer firefighters the only examples of enthusiastic unselfishness to be seen in this land. The examples of that are all through that book, Population 485.
Yeah, I'm always careful. I don't get into the hero talk much. I think that's easily overdone. And I also know that if you're going to speak honestly, you know, any group of volunteer firefighters is like any other group of people. You're going to have folks of different gradations, shall I say. But the bottom line is that, yeah, I found it remains. I was on the New Auburn Fire Department for 12 years. We've recently moved to a little farm in a different district, and I'm serving with a different department. But I was on my hometown fire department for 12 years, and you've been kind enough to mention all the things I've been allowed to do over the past many years. But I'll tell you what, serving 12 years on the New Auburn Fire Department is the single most meaningful thing I've ever done. And the reason for that is that you just saw people from all walks of life. You know, the guy who was cleaning up the beer tent with me is a one-eyed butcher, and he's still my friend. And in some ways, we couldn't be more different. And I write in the book about people fighting over politics and the school board. But when the pager goes off, you got to just set that aside and put your yellow helmet on and get to work. And people do that. And so, yeah, there is at some level. When the pager goes off and you're in making your interior attack, there is a purity to that. There's really, you can't fake it.
You know, in that book, you managed to mix in a lot of really funny recollections of some of those characters, but then it's interspersed with some absolutely horrifying, tragic situations that you encountered as a firefighter. Was that kind of a challenge for you, just hitting such a range of human emotions and experiences, sometimes all within the same page?
Not really, because that's life. And also, I don't have much choice, because the books I do, I generally get assigned to do a memoir about a certain stretch of time, and I don't know when I begin that book what's going to happen over that stretch of time. And so I've had a couple of times when I was writing a book and something happened that was pretty grim, and it had to be included because it took place during that time frame. But I do get asked about that sometimes. But you know, I grew up in an area where folks didn't have a lot. My parents didn't have a lot, but they took care of a lot of children, foster children, who had severe mental and physical disabilities, some terminal. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up familiar with death, and I'm not trying to be dramatic or anything. It was just part of life and illness and misfortune. And I also grew up with people who struggled to make the rent. And so And one of the ways that you dealt with that is this wonderful blue-collar humor. And, I mean, one of my favorite things to talk about is how funny it is when people get hurt. You know, when you were working on the farm, if somebody got kicked by a cow or they stood up and hit their head on the silage blower, as soon as you made sure that they hadn't sustained any real permanent damage, why, nothing was funnier. And I think that's kind of to get back to your question, that's kind of life. I mean, there's horror interspersed with humor.
Well, you see a lot of that on the farm, too, don't you? I mean, you're dealing with farm animals, and they come and they go.
They do, yeah, and you care about them. And, you know, I was just talking the other day to someone about when we grew up on the farm, one of the fun things was all the animals had names, and when my dad was a shepherd, he had sheep for 40-some years, and lambing season is this death march where you're out there. You sleep about 2 hours a day, and you're out there all the time for a month straight. But us kids loved it because Dad kept a clipboard out there, and you got to, if you were there when the lamb got born, you got to name them, and they were named in alphabetical order. And I said, that was all fine. You'd get some fun names like Hezekiah and Herkimer, and but then you eventually you'd hit the, you know, X and Z, and we had a lot of X-rays and Zapatas. And then I also said that with our calves, there weren't so many, so they didn't have to be in alphabetical order, but it was considered a great honor to bestow on someone to name a calf after them. The trouble with that is that you never kept the bull calves. They went on down the road almost immediately. So you were always naming these cows after the women you admired, and I always thought that was kind of a mixed blessing. You know, when you told your girlfriend you liked her so much you named a cow after her, well, frankly, none of them were around long enough to see the calf become a cow.
you not only became a volunteer firefighter, your mom was a firefighter too.
Yeah, my right? mom. Yeah, what happened there is I come out of nursing school and I had my nursing degree, and people, when you have a nursing degree, when someone gets hurt or there's a car wreck, someone says, well, you're a nurse, you know what to do. Well, coming right out of nursing school, you really don't. I mean, if you're an ER nurse or a surgical nurse, you might, and so I thought, you know, I'd like to take one of those EMT courses just so I know what to do if there's trouble. I never intended to actually ride on the ambulance. Well, then I got involved, and now it's been well over, coming up on 25 years. But I decided to take the course, and I talked my brother into taking it with me, the EMT course. And when my mom heard we were doing this, she said, oh, I've always wanted to do something with my boys. I think I'll take that class with you. And so it wound up that she became an EMT with her two eldest sons, and off we went, and we made many, many, many a call together. Still, occasionally, when we're all in the same county, we show up at the same accident.
Michael Perry, he's going to be appearing next Saturday, April 14th. It's a Century Theater. He's with us for the next hour on Route 51. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, working to build the local economy and strengthen the community by making local business everybody's business. Learn more about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg with Michael Perry, who's with us for the next hour. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742. Michael, you grew up in a teetotaling fundamentalist family. Do you think growing up in that environment without a television helped you to learn to write and maybe interact better with people face to face?
Yep. I tend to go on and on with my answers, so I wanted to give you one quick one. But yeah, definitely. I don't know about the interacting so much, but we did not have a television, but my mom taught me to read when I was four, and took us to the library all the time. I say every week or every other week as my memory serves, but we always had stacks and stacks of books, and when I'd come home from school, instead of flopping down on the TV, I'd flop down out on the porch with a book and read, and I read at every opportunity. And my father, the farmer, you know, he worked mm-hmm. hard, but he often said, I really loved to read cowboy books, and in particular, Louis L'Amour cowboy books.
Right.
And he was always finding me with my nose in one of those Louis L'Amour books. And he was known to say, and I quoted him in one of my books, he said, I lost more man hours to Louis L'Amour than to pickup trucks, football, and girls combined.
How did that background, fundamentalist family, how did your own religious beliefs or your own outlook on life grow out of that background?
Well, I think I need to make the distinction. How it affected me is that my parents, who continue in the same church as I was raised, were very quiet people, and they are to this day. And my dad, man, he preached two things to us constantly, and that was charity and humility. And I can't speak for myself, but my father lived that. And so over time, I left the church, but I think I've said before it was more a dissolve than a break. And to this day, I think because of my father's attitude and gentleness, I have no fight there, no bitterness. I just couldn't continue to say I believed something I didn't believe. So I think more than the church, my parents' example shaped how I operate even as an unbeliever, and I hope for the better. And you know, and I, whenever this discussion comes up, I get nervous because I'm no theologian, and I can't. But I just make all these statements about faith from a position of humility because I'm involved in questioning, not declaring.
Well, your parents obviously lived the life that they believed in.
That's the thing. I mean, they're both still alive, but they just, I don't know how to put it other than pretty bluntly, they didn't beat anybody over the head with what they believed. They just lived it, and if you were interested, perhaps you would follow.
Is it true you can still milk a cow in the dark?
Absolutely, not a problem. I'm not, like, seeking the opportunity, but... Yeah, I think that's a little bit, to use the old cliche, like riding a bicycle. Once you've milked a cow in the dark, you can always milk a cow in the dark, although I'd recommend, you know, a nice clean parlor with fluorescent lighting. But in a pinch, I could do it, sure.
And your website is called sneezingcow.com. How come?
Well, that goes, I did a humor album quite a while back, still available at sneezingcow.com, as a matter of fact, both as a CD and a download, if you're interested. And it's called Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow. And that came from, and anybody out there listening who grew up on a farm knows, but when a cow sneezes, it sneezes out the front end, but some pretty impressive things happen out the back end, too. And I'm not talking about milk, and I think you kind of got the picture. And it's, what I tell people is that it's one of those deals where it's like, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. It shouldn't happen to you twice. And I guess what I would end with is that if it has ever happened to you, and it has happened to me, it is a jaw-dropping experience, although that would not be your best move.
In your second book, Truck, A Love Story, you talk about falling in love with a lady named Irma Harding. Who was she?
Oh, yeah, Irma. I spent a couple of pages right there obsessing over Irma. The problem is she never existed. Irma Harding was the Betty Crocker of the international harvester world. The book Truck is a lot about, it is a love story about a truck, but it's also a love story about, I was a bachelor for 39 years, and in that book I write about meeting the woman who became and is, I'm happy to say, my wife. But there was this woman, Irma Harding, that was created just to basically stand as the brand for International Harvester, because at that time, in addition to farm implements and pickup trucks, they were making air conditioners and ovens and stoves and all kinds of appliances. And so Irma Harding was created, and she had these cookbooks, Irma Harding cookbooks, and I think they phased her out after just a couple of years, but when I came across this woman who stood for International Harvester, which is my favorite logo in the whole world, and my International Harvester truck is my sole prized possession beyond my family, when I saw that there was a woman associated with International Harvesters, well, then I naturally was taken by her.
Let's play another short clip from the Clodhopper monologues about you going on a date with a woman in high school in that International Harvester truck.
Naturally, the windshield was cracked. The heater was passable, but in the summer, you'd rely on what a laughing bus driver once described to me as a 280 air conditioner. Roll down two windows and go 80 miles an hour. There were vents on either side of the cab at shin level, but to open them was to unleash a cyclone of alfalfa chaff and dehydrated horseflies. Picture your date perched beside you on a summer's day, her lips glistening with bubblegum lip smackers, and the cab charged with the scent of, gee, your hair smells terrific, shampoo. You're running 50 miles an hour down a gravel road when she grows over warm and bends down to crack a vent. When she rears back, she appears to have emerged from a polluted wind tunnel. Her hair is frosted with feed dust, and she's got pine needles stuck in her banana clip. Her lips are dotted like twin strips of flypaper. And there is a June bug in her braces. You're young. You kiss her anyway.
Michael Perry. Michael, you were a bachelor until pretty late in life. How did you turn that around with that kind of a background? And how is married life and being a father working out for you?
Well, I was a bachelor till I was 39, and I don't, you know, there's probably a lot of reasons for that, and I'm not sure we need to get into any of them. But I can tell you what happened. One day I went to the library, and I met a woman. And I've told the American Library Association they're free to use that quote in all their promotional materials, but so far nothing. And actually, there was a book called Six-Word Memoirs on Love and Heartbreak, where you were asked to tell your story of love or heartbreak in six words.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the story about meeting my wife in six words. I said, bachelor visits library, books wife, nonfiction.
Good.
And so I wound up getting married, and married life has been tremendous. My wife is a great counterbalance to me. I write about this new book I've got coming out. I write about the fact that she's the grown-up in our relationship. And I say that, and people chuckle, but she truly is. She keeps me grounded. She keeps me centered. And she does a great job of kind of, she's the governor on my throttle, if you will. And
mm-hmm.
the example that I like to give is that I did one of those live humor performances recently, and somebody came up to her afterwards and said, oh, it must be just wonderful to be married to Mike. He's so funny. And my wife said, yes, he is. And then with impeccable comedic timing of her own added, on stage.
There you go.
And so that's been great. And my wife is my wife is more educated than I am. She's certainly more attractive than I am, and she's just a wonderful mother to our children. And she holds down the fort. I'm on the road about 100 days a year, and it's nothing fancy. It's mostly just me in the car with a box of books, you know, maybe going to rock the Sheboygan Library or something. But it the fact remains, she's in charge of things on the home front a lot, and that includes some of the animals we raise and our little home business we have going. So I'm very, very fortunate to have her. And then as far as the children, my oldest daughter's 12 now. She was 3 when I met her and her mother. She's a sweet, sweet girl. And probably at the event there in Stevens Point, I'll tell the story about her and the guinea pig, which has become kind of my signature ending piece for a lot of my events. And then I have a younger daughter. She's just about to turn 5 now, and the older daughter's quite gentle and thoughtful and reflective, and you have to be careful with her. You can hurt her feelings.
Mm-hmm.
But my younger daughter, I'm trying to figure out how to hurt her feelings, frankly. She's a good kid, but I say she has got the personality of a D8 caterpillar. She views life as a big pile of dirt, and she just drops her blade and pushes right on through. So.
You know, isn't it amazing how kids are all born with their own personalities?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it couldn't be more night and day. And of course, there are dramatic similarities, of course. There's no question they're sisters. But, yeah, it is funny on the Venn diagram, those outer edges of the Venn diagram on two children,
mm-hmm.
of the same mom. It's amazing.
In Coop, you write about settling down, raising pigs and chickens and children, and growing vegetables in the garden. This whole back to nature thing is a political statement for some people. How does that strike you, having grown up on a farm?
Well, number one, I think it's wonderful. We just, you know, here locally where I live in the Chippewa Valley, there's been such a resurgence of the local food co-op and folks growing things. And and an awareness, you know. And I'm skeptical of that word. I think it gets overused and it's too easy sometimes. But it's just neat that folks are talking about that stuff and thinking about it. On the flip side, because I grew up on a farm and know what a struggle it can be, I also don't completely go for the whole, you know, we're going to get ourselves a patch of land and everything's going to be beautiful. It's like, no, it's going to be a lot of hard work. And we have 37 acres, and frankly, it's 36.5 too many. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, both my wife and I have farming backgrounds. And in the book, I try to write about that struggle to remain realistic. And part of being realistic this year, and it's following many family meetings and long discussions, is that we're basically taking a year off the animals. I was fencing, trying to get some beef going, and we always raise pigs, and we raise a bunch of meat chickens, and we've got two big coops full of laying hens. And I've got a book tour coming up in the fall. I've got another book due in September, and I'm on the road with the band, and I'm off speaking. And I just had to stop and realize that a lot of that time was coming out of family time. And so this year, last year, we grew a couple extra chickens and extra pigs, kind of thinking this might happen. And this year we're taking a little time off. So I think it's wonderful in a nutshell. The other thing that I like to talk about, though, is it also, there tends to be this rural focus. And I think there's just a whole lot of hope happening at the urban end of things. You know,
really?
We're seeing about folks, you know, just in the last couple of days, some study came out about how they're seeing a dramatic decline in the growth of suburbs, and that people are actually turning back toward the center of the city. And I think ultimately that there's some potential there. I'm not an expert on this. I could be talking through my hat, but I just think that some consolidation and people, you know, in our little town here, folks go to the farmer's market and there's this gathering together. And the other big point I like to make is that the whole back to the land thing, you tend to, of course, associate it with everybody moving to the country and getting 40 acres. But the truth is, on my book tours, especially when I was out for Coop, I loved talking to all the people in Seattle and San Francisco and in Denver who have a window box, and they're growing stuff in their apartment. And, you know, that's obviously not enough.
They're growing things on the rooftops in Chicago, you know.
Sure, and obviously we're not to the point where you're not going to replace your grocery bill by doing that, but you're at least getting a sense of things, and you're getting back in touch with the earth, even if it's 12 stories above the ground. So,
Michael Perry, author, humorist, singer-songwriter, radio host, volunteer firefighter, part-time farmer, 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. Michael, I was telling you before the show that we've got at least two things in common. We both like Waylon Jennings, and we both try to garden in northern Wisconsin. The first of those brings me a lot of joy. The second, often a lot of frustration. How about you?
I'd say we're pretty much on the same page. The Waylon thing is fun for me. I grew up not really caring for country music, and then at the age of 16, I started working on a ranch in Wyoming. And I've written about this. I don't remember where, somewhere in one of my books, but I was working on this ranch in Wyoming, and two things happened out there. Number one is if you get in a ranch truck in Wyoming and turn the AM radio on, I got news for you. You're going to hear nothing but country music. And so I kind of had to start listening to it by default. But the Waylon thing is my boss and I, and he was part of this church that we talked about earlier, yeah, and I was still a member at that time. We were way out on top, as we called it, up on a plateau working irrigating one day. And the irrigating out there was all shovels and walking and digging feeder ditches and building rock dams. And we'd spent the whole day toiling at that out in the open. And we realized it was Wednesday, and we were late for Bible study, which was held on Wednesday evening. So we jumped in his big old four-wheel drive pickup truck, and we charged back home down off the plateau and into the valley, and we're roaring up this big, long Wyoming hay meadow, and we didn't realize there was an irrigation ditch right in front of us, and we hit it, and the truck flew up in the air and then slammed back down, and everything in the truck come loose, and everything under the seat came sliding out, including this 8-track tape. And I picked up the 8-track tape, and he still had a functional 8-track player in his truck at that time. I picked it up and looked at it, and I said, "Who's Waylon Jennings?"
Uh-huh.
And my boss said, "Son, you need to jam that thing in there." And so I jammed that 8-track in there, and I heard that, man, I heard that phased Telecaster chicken picking coming out of there, and then I heard Waylon's signature voice, and I was hooked from the very first note and have been ever since.
Right, and that thump, 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 thump.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, the other thing, and this was all long before I had any idea of being a writer or trying to do anything like that, but a little seed was planted, and later it was especially expanded by Steve Earle, but there was this idea that all of a sudden, hey, you could be a roughneck and still care about beauty and art.
When did you start writing your own music?
That was pretty late. I was living alone, and I tend to write in binges. I write every day, but a couple of times a week I'll go 14, 16, 18 hours straight without stopping. And I would do that, and I'd want to take a break, but I wouldn't want to really stop or turn that part of my brain off. And so I got a hold of a guitar, and I learned two chords and then eventually three, and I started just trying to write little songs, and eventually I had about 30 songs. And I was into my 30s before I really started that, probably about the time I turned 30. And eventually I had a buddy of mine say, oh, you ought to play out sometime. You got all those songs. And I don't want to do that. And then he talked me into playing at a coffee shop up in Hayward, Wisconsin. And I ain't saying I was nervous, but, man, I cranked out a 60-minute set in 32 minutes flat. but it didn't go terribly wrong, and then eventually I put together a band. And the
Long Beds, right?
Yeah, tell
us about those guys.
Well, it started out just as informally. There's one guy who's been with me from the get-go. His name's Billy Krause, and he still plays with me. I had two young friends who were musicians, and I did recording with them. The one guy, his name was Justin, and he was in the band. Plus, he and I recorded our first album, Headwinded. He engineered all that and did most of playing on it. And he since has gone. It was Justin Vernon, and he's got a band now called Bon Iver. And he just picked up two Grammys. And,
famous guy.
Oh, we couldn't be prouder of him. And he and I are neighbors now. And I, matter of fact, I saw him yesterday in a total neighbor mode. It had nothing to do with music or anything. We like to say that he used to be a long bed. He'll come crawling back. Is what we like to say.
I want to play a cut of your music off of the CD, your most recent one, Tiny Pilot. This one's called Somewhere South of Sunday. Michael Perry in the Long Beds. Somewhere South of Sunday. It's off of the CD Tiny Pilot. Michael Perry and the Long Beds. Michael, the host of Tent Show Radio, the author of three critically acclaimed books, and he will be appearing at the Century Theater in Stevens Point this next Saturday, April 14th. It is a Wisconsin Public Radio, and there are still tickets available if you're interested in attending that. Michael, who are you listening to right now?
Well, I'm pretty eclectic and kind of listen to whatever helps me write And let's see, in the last 24 hours, I listened to two CDs worth of the Ray Charles country music box set. There was a Ray Charles did a lot of country music.
You know, I Can't Stop Loving You is one of the best country songs ever performed.
Yeah, he's stunning with country music. And I was also I get to hang out with young musicians once in a while, which is good for me because they turn me on to some interesting stuff. And just yesterday I was listening to a band called War on Drugs, and then I also was listening to a guy called Astronautilus, and I'm not even sure what the deal is there, but I enjoyed what I heard. I have a couple of guys that used to be in my band too, in a band called Megafaun, and they're traveling all over the country, matter of fact, all over the world right now. And so I've been listening to some of their stuff, and I tend to go between old school country, and then the other day I was listening to The Cure, Disintegration, mm-hmm. and if I'm feeling mopey. A little bit of everything. I was just the other day listening to
good music is good music, isn't it?
It is, you know, and I get to listen to classical too. I have a young daughter who loves to come up, and she asks to listen to Otis Redding when she comes out and visits me in the morning in my little writing space. And then she also loves to listen to Kathleen Edwards, who is a wonderful singer-songwriter out of Canada. And then at night she asks me to put on classical music on the public radio station as she goes to sleep. So I think she'll be all right between listening to Otis Redding and Kathleen Edwards and classical music. I hope I'm doing the right thing there.
I think so. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back with your phone calls for Michael Perry. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at umr.com.
Let's go to the phones right now for Michael Perry. Let's go to Jeff in Ashland. Jeff, you're on Route 51.
Well, for taking my call, I just wanted to tell Michael I've called him before. I got all three books, and I enjoyed them a great deal, but something interesting happened to me. I was listening to Chapter a Day a couple of years ago, and they were doing Coop. And the last day it was on, I happened to be driving down Highway 53 going towards Twin Cities, but I decided to stop by Auburn and listen to the last chapter. Overlooking a farm, I'm sure was not the Perry Farm, but I was pretending it was because it was in the neck of the woods, and got to hear the eloquent ending of that great book. So I'm a big fan. I look forward to Chautauqua Days and more books.
Well, thank you. I love the idea that that's kind of the ultimate digital slash natural experience, I guess, listening to Chapter a Day on your radio and looking out across the countryside I wrote about. And Ashland, I love Ashland up there. Matter of fact, just the other day, I was wearing my Black Cat Coffee House t-shirt. But yeah, I appreciate that. And Chapter a Day, it's been so good to me. And I have a fun little story. At least it's fun for me. On my very first book tour, I was driving across Nebraska all by myself, been on the road for weeks, just trying to get people to look at my book. And the publicist called from New York City, and he said, you know, there's this radio station that's called, and they want to read your book on the air. It sounds kind of strange. It's called Chapter a Day. What should we tell them? And I said, you need to call them back immediately and say yes. Chapter a Day has been wonderful to me. I hear from a lot of mail carriers who listen to Chapter a Day and have heard my books on there.
Well, Jeff, thanks so much for the phone call. We really appreciate you calling in. Michael, what do you think of the loss of Wisconsin's small family farms and those big mega farming operations that have replaced them?
You know, it's tough. I've written in my books that I'm trying never to become that guy, which it seems like when you hit 40, you just become this guy who sits on his porch and just yells at the kids to stay off his lawn and talks about how things aren't the way they used to be. I don't have any big answer for that. And part of the reason I don't have any big answer for that is because I've got relatives who are doing big farming, and they came from small farming.
And it's hard to be nostalgic about something if you can't make a living at it.
Exactly. And that's where it gets tricky, because this circles back to our discussion about being self-supporting back to land. But here's what gives me hope. I hear all the time from people who are finding ways to make it as small farmers, whether it's organic, whether it's just local foods, or whether they've just decided, you know what, we're going to trim our lives down to a size where we can support ourselves. And so, as always, I don't have the answer. And I do think we sometimes burn a little too much time demonizing each other. We're all trying to make a living. What I like is people who just say, well, the big things are going to unfold. In the meantime, I'm going to get to work on my little patch. And you know what? I'm seeing a lot of that, and, mm-hmm. and that's encouraging.
What do you think of what's happening in Wisconsin right now politically? I'm not asking you for a political statement, but more a reflection of how polarized things are, how angry people are, and how people are no longer talking to each other.
Well, the thing you just said at the end is the issue, and I do get asked a lot to take positions on this or that, or to endorse this candidate or not, and I don't do it. And I've had people get pretty upset with me, and I've had people say they're not going to buy my books anymore if I don't say this or that. And I will say I'm a guy who avoids conflict perhaps more than I should, but when you tell me, you know, I do have a backbone if you try to push me.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do do, my own fire department, my own church, my own neighborhood, and my own family is deeply split on many of these political issues. And so what I do is I will talk to them, I'll talk to my neighbor, and we'll do the best we can. And then we have skin in the game in the sense that we can't afford to just dismiss each other out of contempt. And that's the best I can do. That's the best answer I have, is I try to just deal with it on my, because if you can make a public statement and then someone uses one line to cudgel someone else, and
it takes a line of yours out of context, in other words.
Yeah, and it's not even, I'm not even talking about this whole idea that someone's trying to be malevolent. It's just that these are difficult issues that require you to sit on your neighbor's porch for hours. You know, I've got a guy down the road from me where I live in the country, and he and I suspect have not covered a lot of the same side of the ballot in over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? His heart is failing him, and so he's had some issues. And so last summer he needed help baling hay, so I helped him bale hay. And the reason I did that is because when I was off on book tour and didn't get my plowing done, he came up and plowed for me and helped my wife get the field ready. I'm not trying to be evasive, nor am I trying to be Pollyanna, but at some level, you got to live together and you got to work together. And I think when it gets to be what it is, it's all out in the realm of the web. And, you know, we're sort of playing politics the way we use drones. You know, you take shots at people you never meet. And I just, Adam, can hear me running out of steam.
Well,
it's just personal. You got to take care of it on a personal level.
The internet is a wonderful thing in a lot of ways, but
it's a wonderful
boy.
Tool,
it has magnified the good and the bad in the human condition.
Well, and it keeps coming back to personal responsibility, and your personal responsibility is not just to spend all your time in a place where people are saying things you want to hear, and that goes for all of us. Me especially. I'm as vulnerable as anybody, man, and I get nervous talking about this stuff because people get so hot, and I'm not that articulate when it comes to these issues, but I can only go with my gut, and my gut says I got to get along with my neighbor, and we've got to, you know, fight this out in with a ballot. And
I hear you. You seem to, Michael, really love all the things that repulse cultured people. You know, lawn ornaments, rusty old trucks and cars. Beer guzzling
maybe
softball players.
Maybe I repulse cultured people. I don't know.
Old men with their cheeks full of chewing tobacco. You find something beautiful in those things.
Well, I don't know. It was beautiful. It's comfortable. It's where I come from. Now, I also, though, go to great lengths to, you know, I can also be guilty of this disingenuous, you know, by gosh, I don't need nothing more sophisticated than a bag of feed. When in truth, my life has been made immeasurably rich by people who took the time to talk to a knucklehead like me about poetry and art and dance. You know, I don't get to New York City very often, about once every 2-3 years. But when I do, I try to get down to Chelsea and see some modern dance at the Joyce Theater. And that's because there's a guy up in Rusk County, Wisconsin, who, against all odds, had a dance studio. And I ran into him, and I learned about dance from him. And, you know, and then went back home to the softball game where everybody's chewing and spitting because I feel comfortable there. But, yeah, I'm comfortable in that world, but I also, I don't ever want to be one of those. There's, you know, it gets back to that politics thing. We seem to be, you got to be one or the other. You know, you're either an intellectual or you're just a regular guy. Well, you know.
Life is a little too complex and too complicated for that, isn't it?
I'd hope so, and I'm not the guy to lead anybody anywhere. But, I, you know, this is what it comes back to. This thing is not about me having some sort of refined or omnivorous taste. I feel like I'm the lucky guy that I actually do enjoy being at the poetry reading, and I enjoy going to the dirt track stock car races.
Michael, we're out of time. Thank you, and I agree, you are the lucky guy. Michael Perry, the host of Tent Show Radio, the author of Population 485, Truck, A Love Story, Coop, Your Poultry, Pigs, and Parenting. He's got a new book coming out in August, is that it?
Yes, sir, August 21st.
And you can hear Michael's live performances on the 2-CD set, the Clodhopper Monologues, and you can see him next Saturday, April 14th, at the Century Theater in Stevens Point. It's a Wisconsin Public Radio and Tomorrow River Chautauqua show. You can also find out more about Michael at his website, sneezingcow.com, and his latest CD with his band, The Long Beds, is called Tiny Pilot. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producers, Crystal Bennis and Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme, and thank you for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. Until next week, we're heading out of town.